showers. Temperatures 11 to 13 Celsius. It'll be cold again on Thursday night, particularly in the west, with clear skies. Further east, it won't be as cold because the cloud will spill in, bringing some outbreaks of rain. And on Friday, it looks like being damp in the east, generally dry and bright in the west, with sunny spells and just a few showers, but more rain for many of us and staying cool into the weekend. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. And now on BBC Radio 4, pull down the shutters and wrap up warm. Immerse yourself in our Book of the Week. And matters of political reform loom large during the reign of William IV. This time, crucial speeches and all-night parliamentary debates steal the show in Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser.
In January 1831, the energetic Committee of Four was struggling with the details of reform. They acted in a state of rising excitement. Lord Grey wrote to Sir Herbert Taylor, the King's private secretary, expressing his credo on the subject. "The perilous question is that of parliamentary reform, and as I approach it, the more I feel all its difficulty. With the universal feeling that prevails on this subject, it is impossible to avoid doing something, and not to do enough to satisfy public expectation would be worse than to do nothing." Taylor wrote back to Grey on the King's behalf. The King was not surprised his Prime Minister should approach parliamentary reform with dread. The King wondered whether the whole movement for reform was not a specious cloak for the introduction of republicanism. This wasn't a sovereign who was going to make it easy for anyone to solve the perilous question. Lord John Russell rose to move the first reading of the Bill for Parliamentary Reform in England and Ireland on Tuesday, the 1st of March, 1831. Standing in the middle, he declared, "We fix ourselves on what is, I hope, firm and steadfast ground between the abuses we wish to amend and the convulsions we hope to avert." Lord John Russell then proceeded in great detail to outline the plan on which the Committee of Four had agreed, and the Cabinet as a whole had endorsed. For a while, his audience could hardly believe what they were hearing. Then, as the radical nature of what he was proposing began to sink in, his speech was punctuated with cheers. Some of these were cheers of enthusiasm, others of disbelieving derision. After a while, there were bouts of what Sir John Hobhouse called wild, ironical laughter. Towards the end of Lord John's speech, Sir Robert Peel actually put his head in his hands. There were two main propositions: redistribution and clarification of the right to vote. As a result of the first, all boroughs with less than 2,000 inhabitants were to be totally disenfranchised, a total of 60 boroughs. There were to be 27 new boroughs, and 168 MPs would lose their seats. 500,000 would be added to the electorate. The most violent reaction of the House came when Russell started to read out the names of the boroughs which would be disenfranchised, while others would be reduced. Members of Parliament, listening to Russell, found their seats blandly eliminated. In his final peroration, Russell appealed to the aristocracy. "The gentlemen of England have never been found wanting in any great crisis. I ask them now, when a great sacrifice is to be made, to show their generosity, to convince the people of their public spirit, and to identify themselves for the future with the people." When Lord John finally sat down, there was disbelief and finally a reaction. In the general hubbub, it was some time before Sir Robert Inglis, for the Tories, could make himself heard. This gentleman of England was verging on the apoplectic in his response to Lord John's call. Whatever Lord John Russell's intentions might be, the object of this bill cannot be restoration, cannot then be reform, but in a single word is and must be revolution.
I hope God will forgive you on account of this bill, said Lord Sidmouth to Lord Grey on the day of Russell's speech. I don't think I can. The Duke of Wellington was giving a dinner party, and when the first reports reached him of what was being proposed, simply declined to believe them. There must be some mistake. The next day, the most notable feature of the debate on the 2nd of March was the rise of a new star on the Whig horizon. With his high forehead, hair already receding, and heavy brows above piercing eyes, Thomas Macaulay dominated by sheer brilliance rather than physique. As Greville put it, a lump of more ordinary clay never enclosed a powerful mind and lively imagination. Sydney Smith called him a book in breeches. There was something odd about Macaulay's diction, which mesmerised hearers in this vital session of Parliament.
Turn where we may, within, around, the voice of great events is proclaiming to us reform that you may preserve.
On the 3rd of March, Sir Robert Peel rose in the House of Commons to mount the official attack for the Tories. Unlike the Duke of Wellington, Peel was careful not to set his face publicly against all change. He was in favour of reforming every institution that really required it, but he preferred to do so gradually, dispassionately, and deliberately, in order that reform might be long-lasting. The Whigs remained extremely confident, and they were bolstered by the support of the Radicals. Francis Place, who had once dismissed gabbling Whigs, now felt considerable enthusiasm for what was happening. William Cobbett became a bill man, heart and soul. The Times thundered, "To the House, we should say, pass it, pass it. To the people, urge in every way the passing of the bill, call for it, press it forward." The process of debate which followed was long and exhausting, much of it taking place at night. The young Charles Dickens was one of those in attendance as a reporter, and wrote on the 7th of March that he was so exceeding tired from his week's exertions that he had slept on the sofa the whole day. Meanwhile, reform continued to be the talk of fashionable London. Lord Grey called across to Creevey at dinner at his own house.
"Do you think, Creevey, we shall carry our reform bill in the Lords?"
The diarist remarked on the Prime Minister's renewed vitality.
"All alive-o, quite overflowing."
Certainly, no political measure had ever before gained such countrywide, almost breathless attention.
The best dressed, the handsomest, and apparently the happiest man in all his royal master's dominions.
Thus Creevey described Lord Grey, standing in his own drawing room, with his back to the fire on the 25th of March, 1831, 2 days after the vote in favour of the second reading of the bill had been carried by a single vote.
"The cause of reform looks cheerily," declared the Times on the 29th of April.
All the same, the Thunderer felt that there was a warning to be given before the general election of early summer of 1831.
"Let no man listen to any terms of compromise. A half-reform is no reform."
The new Parliament, which was summoned for the 14th of June, contained members overwhelmingly in favour of reform. In the House of Commons, that is. The hereditary House of Lords was another matter. What the Whigs called the frightful superiority of our enemy, the inbuilt Tory majority in the upper house, continued to be a source of anticipatory concern. What would happen if this house refused to pass a bill which had been endorsed by the Commons?
There was one radical solution which Grey discussed with Lord Holland in a letter as early as the 2nd of June. That was the creation of new peers by the sovereign. But what if King William refused? On the 24th of June, Lord John Russell moved a measure in the name of the government which, in their opinion, is calculated to maintain unimpaired the prerogatives of the Crown, the authority of both Houses of Parliament, and the rights and liberties of the people of this kingdom. Among the possible obstacles he listed, with a hint of menace, were those most dangerous weapons, unwarranted and slanderous as they were, which imputed to the sovereign a will different from that of his constitutional advisers. But he had nothing but praise for the people of England. The sacrifices made and the devotedness shown in the recent election. On the 6th of July, Sir Robert Peel acknowledged that the feeling of the country was currently in favour of reform, but questioned whether the excitement wouldn't soon die down. This was an intense period of debate and late-night argument in the House of Commons as the bill went towards the committee stage. The country as a whole basked in magic weather. At one point, the Tory Lord Ellenborough, a close friend of the Duke of Wellington, noted in his diary that it was very hot and quite beautiful, adding a pointed reference to last year's French Revolution. It is the anniversary of the first of the glorious days which have produced so much mischief in Europe. For the MPs, conditions were much less idyllic, as they argued in the stifling heat of their cramped and old-fashioned abode on the great issue. Late night, or rather early morning, sittings were the norm. Irritability grew to a new high as the parties took to drafting in fresh members after dawn broke, who returned to the attack with zest, to the horror of their sleep-deprived opponents. The bill passed on the 7th of July with a majority of 136. In all this, Lord Althorp, stout figure of integrity that he was, played an important part as leader of the House, while bemoaning the circumstances which kept him away from his country estate. Althorp's reaction to a performance by the great violinist Paganini at St. James's Palace sums up his discomfort in London society.
He certainly made every noise that could be made with a fiddle, and a great many more than I ever heard before.
But once was enough, wrote Althorp.
I never wish to hear him again.
Regarding politics, he confided to a friend that though it was all he could do not to drive away when his carriage came to fetch him, once in the melee of the House, he recovered his spirits. As the date of William IV's coronation approached in the first week of September, MPs were ragged with their debating in committee, while the country simmered with enthusiasm for reform. There were 40 separate sittings before the bill finally passed its prolonged committee stage at 7 p.m. on the 7th of September, 1831. And the country gave itself up to the glories of the coronation.
Adrian Scarborough was reading from Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow, the bishops will halt proceedings at the same time here on BBC Radio 4, where now you can hear the strains of Sailing By filtering through, carrying us on a musical tide towards the shipping forecast. And now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 16th of May. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Bailey, Faroes and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low southeast, Fair Isle 989, moving away steadily northwards by 1800 today. New lows expected Faroes 1001 and northeast Fitzroy 995 by the same time. Low northwest Hebrides 991 losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, southeasterly 6 to gale 8, decreasing 3 or 4, backing northeasterly later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. South Utsira, east 40s, southerly or southeasterly 5 to 7, decreasing 3.